Well, turn, if you would please, to John chapter 18. John chapter 18, starting in verse 38. Verse 38. Here's the scoop. I put our map back up on the screen here. This is Jerusalem during the time of Jesus. That's what it was shaped like. You're looking straight down on top of it. That way's north, south, east, west. Jesus started his day. The day, we've been in the same day now, all the way almost 4 months ago, 4.5 months ago, same day. Jesus started over in this area right here. The Last Supper took place in this place called the Essene Quarter, where he exited out here, went down the Kidron Valley and up the Kidron Valley, up to this place called Gethsemane, the place of the olive press, literally. And there's still an olive orchard there today, though it's not the same trees as Jesus' day. They were all cut down by the Romans in 70 AD for the terrible siege that they laid to Jerusalem. Jesus is arrested here. He's brought back probably by the same route that he took, back up through the Essene Gate, through the Essene Quarter, and into an area somewhere around here, where Caiaphas' house, Annas' house, Annas first, and then Caiaphas, maybe they were next door neighbors, maybe they were in the same house. They were the high priests. I want to remind you of a fact here that, again, comes into play a little bit later in what we're talking about today, that Annas was sort of the grand master of high priests. He held the high priesthood for a number of years before retiring, but then he exercised power over the high priests there. They had to do, if they wanted to do anything out of the ordinary, out of the routine, out of the ceremony, they had to go to Annas to get permission. Caiaphas is a high priest, and he has been a high priest on again, off again, and also at times continuously for a number of years as well. According to Jewish law, that's illegal. They were appeasing the Romans, and they were also using Roman power to stay in authority. The high priests were Sadducees. Sadducees were the Jewish sect of naturalists. And what I mean by that is that they believed in everything they could see, but they didn't believe in what they couldn't see except for God and His law, and that was it. They didn't believe in heaven, hell, and afterlife, spirits, ghosts, souls, nothing. That's what the Sadducees were. They ran the Temple Mount. They ran all the temple procedures. These were the guys in charge. There were other Jewish sects. You know them well. The Pharisees, the scribes, the Essenes you're not so familiar with. But they were, you know, again, down here, and they were the ones who made the Dead Sea Scrolls. And they're referred to in the Bible, in the New Testament, though not mentioned by name. But you can spot them once in a while just because of the type of people walking by in a particular scene. And there were Herodians, and we talked about them way back a couple of years ago in John when Jesus actually healed a Herodian's son. And that was a miracle. And boy, who wants to mess with the Herodians? They deal with the Herods. And nobody likes the Herods in Judea. They all hate them unless you have political aspirations. So Jesus now is brought up here to the high priest's house. He's interrogated by Annas. He's put on a kangaroo court trial in front of Caiaphas. He's held there until day just barely begins to break. And that's when the Romans get going. They didn't wake up Pontius Pilate. He was already out of bed and had his coffee and everything. So he's ready to go. They haul him over to this area right here. This is Herod's palace. This map is incorrect. The palace area was actually much larger. It was actually about this big. Now, you need to know how the size is here. The Temple Mount area here, that enclosure right there, 35 acres. You can imagine this is several acres right here. I can't tell you how many, but it's probably at least 10 acres that Herod's palace was built on. So it's a big, big structure. This is a model. I've showed you this picture before. It's in Jerusalem, and it happens to be at the Israel Museum. These are people here. It shows you the size of the model. They're standing next to it. And this is very, very accurate. It's not entirely accurate, but the inaccuracies are very, very minor. But the man who put this together took 20-some years doing it, and this is his model of Herod's palace. Temple Mount's over here. That way is south. The Essene Quarter, where the Last Supper took place, would be in this area. This is a three-dimensional model. Herod's palace is got two sides. It by history, when we read about the histories of the Jews, especially from people like Josephus and Philo, if you're wondering where I get all this stuff, and they refer to Pontius Pilate, even by name, as occupying the palace. It would have been the north end of the palace, closest to the gate, because this is the part of the palace with the swimming pool. Pontius Pilate is a very arrogant man, and he likes the luxuries of being governor. And remember, his headquarters was actually in Caesarea down on the coast. That was his headquarters, because who wants to be in Jerusalem when you can have a beach house? And his beach house looked something like that. And he had a swimming pool there. And I'm not talking about the ocean. There was actually a swimming pool carved out of solid rock on a peninsula that stuck straight out into the ocean, and it had fresh water in it. And then you could go in the ocean if you wanted to, or go fishing or whatever you wanted to do. That was where he lived all year round, except when he had to come to Jerusalem during the Passover, and he lived here. Now, there's this large courtyard, well over an acre in size, maybe a couple of acres in size. The scales are gigantic. That's how King Herod the Great built. King Herod the Great was not a great guy. He was a mean, rotten scoundrel. But he wanted to be remembered, so he built absolutely colossal structures. And this was one of them. Now, on this side over here, I need to point something out, because we're going to get right into this. On this side over here, you have Herod Antipas. That's Herod the Great's son, one of them. Now, this is the one that hasn't been exiled yet or killed. He's Herod Antipas. He's the one who had John the Baptist arrested, and Salome did the Dance of the Seven Veils, and then the whole scandal with that, and had John the Baptist's head cut off. That's this guy right in here. So he's over here. Pontius Pilate hates Herod. Herod hates Pontius Pilate. They're at opposite ends of the palaces, but hey, they don't talk to each other, and they're really far away. And so he's got his own army over here, Pontius Pilate, the Praetorians, who are an elite bodyguard of Roman officials. And there's a number of them in here. Nobody knows really how many there were, but they're guessing between probably about 60 and 160. And they also live in the palace with him. They're his official bodyguard, and they're an elite Roman force. They're here. Now, what I wanted to point out to you, just so you can picture this in your mind as we read this, because what we're reading happened. It happened in time and space, in a place. And it happened in this area, probably right here. What this is a marketplace. This is an upscale neighborhood. You can tell the houses are big here. The houses are tiny over here. You can see a lot of them in this area here. Just you barely see them, but they're there. But this is where the rich people live. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, and some of the scribes lived in this area. And this was a marketplace here. But in marketplaces in the Roman world, they always had a judgment seat for a magistrate, because that's where you could get gatherings of people and keep them out of your palace, keep them out of your house. So they would set up a platform. Platform being about 8 feet high, about 20 to 30 feet wide. In some cases, it was 90 to 100 feet wide. It just depended on the structure. And it was usually set up bordering a marketplace. Why am I telling you all of this? I said it before last time. They call that in the Roman world a bema seat. We talk about the bema seat, the judgment seat of Christ, the bema of Christ. But Paul uses that word talking about a platform where a judge comes to lay a judgment on people. And they were everywhere. They weren't just in Corinth. They were all over the Greco-Roman world. This is where the judgments take place. Now, that catches us up to where we are. Jesus is on trial in the morning. He's dragged before Pilate for an official trial before the Romans, because now they think they've got him. They can put him on trial and actually have the Romans kill him. And they thought through the leverage that needs to happen in all of this. So they take Jesus over here to this marketplace, and they start shouting. Pilate comes out, and he goes up onto the bema, which you wouldn't see behind this wall here, but it would have been over in this area. And they would have all been gathered here. They would not have gone into here, even though Herod was in here. Herod wasn't a Jew. Herod was a convert to Judaism, and only out of political convenience. Herod was an Idumean, which means he came from what we would call the country of Jordan. So he was more an Arab than he was a Jew. He is over here. Pilate's over here. The Jews won't come through that gate because it will make them unclean ceremonially for the Passover. And they're right in the middle of the Passover when this happens. So Pilate comes out here, and Jesus is brought to him, and the trial began. Well, we've been reading through all of this. And we're going to pick it up where Jesus and Pilate were talking, and Jesus tells Pilate, I came, this is my purpose, to be king, but not now. If I were to, if my kingdom were of this world, my disciples would fight. But my kingdom is not of this world. And of course, he tells them, you say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world to bear witness of the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Almost an invitation to Pilate. In fact, I think it was. Listen to me, Pilate. You have your chance. Pilate said to him, verse 38, what is truth? And after he said this, he went back outside to the Jews and told them, I find no guilt in him. That tells us that Jesus was brought in here by Pilate. Pilate's having a private conversation with him, maybe even back into the building. But he goes back outside and he's talking to the Jews and he says, I find no guilt in him. He hasn't done anything wrong. But you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. So do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews? And they cried out, not this man, but Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a robber. Please understand that even though we're going into chapter 19, that John didn't put chapter breaks in his book. It all just flows right into the next chapter. But we need to pause right there. Barabbas was a robber. Barabbas was an insurrectionist. The word robber is a poor translation. The guy was a rebel. He caused problems for the Romans. He liked to kill Romans and kill tax collectors and collaborators with the Romans. He might have been a zealot, and they had him. He was making trouble for Pilate, and Pilate now had him as a prisoner. Pilate thinks this is going to be an easy step. A large crowd is beginning to gather over here. It's early in the morning. That's typical again. And he says, look, you have a custom. Which one do you want me to release? Your king? And he thinks there might be some merit to this in their minds. He's trying to think inside their heads. He's not doing a good job of it, though. Or this guy, Barabbas. Well, you've got all these righteous guys out here, these priests and representatives of the religious factions of Jerusalem. Are they going to want an insurrectionist who is probably a murderer many times over to be released? Pilate is playing the violin here, so to speak. Unfortunately, they're not hearing the music. You see, Pilate wants Barabbas dead. Barabbas is the problem. Jesus isn't a problem, not to him. He's a problem to the Jews, the Jewish leadership, but not to Pilate. Pilate could care less. And he's thinking, well, way too inside the box, so to speak, that Jesus is just a Jew, and when he brings him out and he offers Barabbas to Jesus, then they'll say, no, kill Barabbas and we'll take Jesus. And they don't do it. Instead, they cry otherwise. Over in Luke chapter 23, verse 6, I'm going to be jumping around here only because we have to fill in the story. Remember, there are no contradictions in the Bible. But there are different perspectives written by different people who saw things and wrote them down and wrote not conflicting accounts, but filled in the gaps of each other's accounts as the Holy Spirit led them to do so. When you put the whole story together, it becomes quite coherent. If you read Matthew's account, Mark's account, Luke's account, John's account, you say, they're all different, but there are some similarities. But when you look at the timing and you put it together, suddenly it creates really a very, very intense situation. So over in Luke chapter 23, verse 6, when Pilate heard this is filling in the gap, he heard these guys saying, no, we want him dead. We want Barabbas. We don't want this man. Not this man. Barabbas. Barabbas was a robber. When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean, speaking of Jesus. We don't often think of Jesus like this, but do you know that Jesus had a Galilean accent? He did. He had a Galilean accent, whatever that sounded like. I don't know. Of course, if you've watched a lot of Hollywood, you know that Jesus actually had a British accent. He had a Galilean accent, whatever that amounted to. And verse 7, and when he, Pilate, learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time. Herod was there for the Passover. Pilate is here. Herod is here. Pilate has Jesus now over here, and you're a Galilean. I can use this. Now, it sounds like Herod is becoming a coward. Pilate's becoming a coward. Let's let Herod deal with the situation. I'll get him off my hands. I don't want him on my hands. But that really wasn't the point. You say, I always thought it was. Yeah, it's very easy to think that. You see, Pilate and Herod hate each other. Herod is a very easy man to hate. Pilate is a very easy man to hate. Both of these guys are opponents of each other. Herod wants more power. Pilate has power, but Pilate doesn't want to be in Judea. It's all a lose-lose for everyone. And between those types of situations, Pilate and Herod have learned to really, really despise one another. Well, here comes Pilate, and he sends Jesus now over to Herod. What is it? Is he dumping Jesus on Herod? Is it a joke? No, it's a political maneuver. And here's what happens. When he found out that it belonged to Herod's jurisdiction and Herod was over that area of Galilee, he was a puppet king of Rome, but his jurisdiction was Galilee, who himself was in Jerusalem at that time. Verse 8, when Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him. In fact, you may remember that Herod even sent a message to Jesus through his disciples that he wanted to see Jesus, and Jesus knew Herod's motives. Herod wanted a play. He wanted magic tricks. He wanted to see someone jump through his hoops that he might be able to use. And Jesus insulted Herod by saying, "You go tell that fox." Wow. Those are strong words from the Lord. And it's really the only time he called somebody by such a name, not to their face. Herod wasn't there, and he sent back that message. But he did say it publicly, because Jesus is not a slanderer. He never did. You'd find times where he really gets after the Pharisees. But the Pharisees were standing right there when he said it. So he was calling them to task. So this is the only time that he makes a very, very significant insult and sends it back at Herod. He wants nothing to do with that man. Herod cut off John the Baptist's head. Jesus mourned heavily for John the Baptist. They were friends. They were cousins. And he knew Herod's motives. And he was a wicked man. So, here comes Jesus. Herod's happy. He long desired to see. He heard about him. He was hoping to see some sign done by him. Put on a show, Jesus. So he questioned him at some length, but he made no answer. The chief priests and scribes stood by vehemently accusing him, and Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then, arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. Jesus said nothing. He was absolutely silent as these things began to transpire. Herod's mocking him. A play that came out a number of years ago that every once in a while makes a revival. I mentioned it a few weeks ago. Jesus Christ Superstar. I do not recommend it. As a matter of fact, I recommend highly against it. It has terrific music. But the doctrine of Jesus Christ Superstar could not be further from the truth. Except for one song. When Jesus is in front of Herod. And Herod begins to mock him. So you are the Christ. You're the great Jesus Christ. Do a miracle. Walk across my swimming pool. And wow, he nailed it. The author nailed it. That one song, which is a strange irony because the whole play mocks Jesus. And the one time he got it right was a mockery of Jesus by a wicked man. Herod wants entertainment. He wants to see Jesus do something that he's heard so much about. And so he questioned him at length, but he made no answer. Verse 10, the chief priests and the scribes standing by accusing him, as if Herod could do anything about it without Rome's permission. And Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him. Finally, it went from show me something to, ah, you're not going to do anything. And whatever they did to him, it was shameful. And then arraying him in splendid clothing. King of the Jews, it's a mockery. Besides, he's got clothes to spare. He hangs a robe on him and sent him back to Pilate. But here's the thing. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day. For before this, they had been at enmity with each other. Huh. Why? Why did they become friends? Because by Pilate sending Jesus to Herod, Pilate affirmed Herod's jurisdiction. Where before, they were at odds with each other and didn't like each other's authority. This was throwing Herod a bone. He sent Jesus to him, knowing that if he could get Herod on his side, he's not thinking about Christians or religion. He's just thinking about ruling the region. And if Herod would cooperate with him, just cooperate, then things will go a lot better. I'll send Jesus over to him. And in doing so, I'm saying you have jurisdiction to judge him. And that assuaged Herod. And they became friends. Jesus is a political pawn at this point. But it also reveals the character of the Herods for all to see. Jesus put it on display when he said nothing to Herod because he had nothing to hear from him and nothing to do for him. The man was lost. And it also sends a message through John, as the Holy Spirit had him write this letter, that this is what the Herods were like. They were not good guys. Not ever, not once. They were always doing bad things. A very, very corrupt group of people. Well, verse 13 there in Luke. Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers of the people and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was misleading the people. After examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod." So, wow, we've got a double whammy back on these guys who are trying to manipulate Pilate and manipulate Herod, for he sent him back to us. "Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will punish him, therefore, and release him." Now, if you know the gospel story, you know what that meant. But there are some questions about it. So let's deal with that for just a second. First of all, let's go back to John now. Actually, I am sorry. Go to Matthew. Matthew 27. Matthew 27. Verse 15. Now, as you're turning there, I will read John. Don't turn to John, just turn to Matthew. "But after he said this," we read this before, "but he went back outside to the Jews and told them, 'I find no guilt in him, but you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. So, do you want me to release to you the King of the Jews?' And they cried out again, 'Not this man, but Barabbas.'" And Barabbas was a robber or an insurrectionist. Matthew 27, verse 15. "Now, at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the crowd any one prisoner whom they wanted. And they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas." What does Barabbas mean? Bar, son of. Abbas. Are you familiar with the name Abba? Son of the Father. There is also a possibility, it's a tradition, so don't take it as history, but it is a possibility, that the reason he is called Barabbas instead of by his first name is that his first name might have been Yeshua. Jesus Barabbas, Jesus Son of the Father. Remember, God teaches through ironies. And this may be one big one. But we have to leave that to legend or perhaps tradition until somebody digs something up, because it's not in the Bible. But we do know that Barabbas means son of the Father, and Jesus, of course, is the Son of His Father. He's the Son of God, and you have two different people that essentially have the same name on trial. And that's fascinating. So, in Matthew, verse 17. So when they had gathered, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Messiah?" For he knew that it was out of envy that they delivered him up. And of course, Pilate was correct on that. Besides, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, you know about that now, his wife sent word to him. Now, she probably didn't walk out there. She probably told somebody, "Go tell him. Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream." Remember, today doesn't mean she was taking an afternoon nap. This is in the morning, early in the morning, and day started at sunset. So she slept at night. During that time, she has a dream about Jesus, and she says to her husband through a messenger, "Let him go. Stay away from him. He is dangerous. There's something very, very important about him that is spiritual." When I say dangerous, not as an insurrectionist, but you're messing with someone who is bigger and higher than you. Don't do it. I've had a dream. And these people in those days, Romans included, they were pagans. They put a lot of stock in dreams. They put a lot of stock in signs and wonders and these sorts of things. And so when Pilate's wife comes up, sends the message, Pilate probably was very, very disturbed, if not angered, by that whole thing. Okay, so now we've got that point. Now, turn over to Luke chapter 23. Luke chapter 23. Filling in the blanks. Verse 18. With one voice, they cried out. Who is they? These are the Jewish leaders who brought Jesus before Pilate. Jesus is now back with Pilate. Pilate has not punished him yet, but he's about to. They cried out, "Away with this man! Release Barabbas to us!" And Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. And wanting to release Jesus, now Pilate's getting troubled. He originally wanted to release Jesus so that he could kill Barabbas. Execute him, because he can do it that day. He can speed the process up. Justin could take its wheels that day. But here comes Jesus. This is the perfect tool, and suddenly it's backfiring on him. And now he wants Jesus released, but now he wants it even more so because his wife is troubled by this whole thing. She's had a dream. Now weight is gaining on Jesus. And wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again. But they kept shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Now, we know that. We'd say, "Crucify him, crucify him." And we see it in the movies and we hear it in the plays. I think it's possible, as it's translated into English, that even in Aramaic or Greek, whichever they were speaking to Herod, or to Pilate in, whichever language, and it could have been either, that they were not saying, "Crucify him." They were saying, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Because Barabbas is up there on the platform too. And they're shouting for Jesus. If they're crucify him, it could mean anybody. Crucify him! And you can see the intensity in what's going on now. You can see the crowd. For the third time, Pilate speaks to them. "Why? What crime has this man committed?" "Jesus, I have found in him no grounds for death." You've seen that picture before. I find it very romantic in the way that it's painted. But there again is sort of a rendering of Pilate with Jesus before the crowds. This huge building here, nah, but it would have been a big building that he was standing next to. It would have been huge. "What crime is he? I found no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him punished and then release him." Chapter 19. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. Now, If you're a student of the Bible and you read a commentary, you read something online about this whole event, you will have split opinions on something here. When they flogged Jesus, when Pilate had him flogged, in what manner did they flog him? You say, who cares? No, there were different ways of doing things in those days. Now, when Pilate says, I will have him punished, that implies something very interesting. It implies that they would have whipped him with a leather whip with five or six leather thongs on it and lashed him with that. And they would have lashed him maybe 20, maybe 30, in this case 39 times, but lashed him with it. It's a punishing lash. It's like saying, give him 30 lashes, that sort of a thing. And that's what a lot of people believe Jesus was whipped. Now, you get whipped with leather thongs 39 times, you're going to be a horrible mess. However, there is another possibility which many people adhere to when you read about it. And I'm only telling you this because I know many of you are students of the Bible. You will dig into this and you're going to run across these things. And I want to clear something up. The other possibility was an interrogation of prisoner, which means that they would whip him with what we call a cat of nine tails. And why the Romans did this was to extract a confession from a prisoner. So typically what they would do is they would take the prisoner and they would lash him with a cat of nine tails until he confessed to a crime. And then they would continue to lash him, saying, did you do this too? Did you do that too? Did you do that too? And they'd add all these different crimes that this man they know didn't commit. But if he said yes to it, then they would lash him a little lighter, not as hard. And they would ease up on him. And with that, they'd be able to close the books on all these cold cases that they had out there. And they could tag crimes on him. He confessed to it. Therefore, you know, close the books on the crime. And it cleaned things up very nicely. So they would whip you. And then they would hit you harder, asking you the question, did you do this? And then they would whip you harder, asking the question, did you do this? And if you wouldn't confess to it, they would hit you harder. If you did confess, they would hit you lighter. That's how they did it, to extract confessions, a form of brutal torture. Here's what they did. They would take the prisoner and they would arc him over a column about that high. Just a Roman, just a, like a stone column, but broken off. You know, broken columns all over the place during construction. They'd carve these things up and then someone would crack or break and they wouldn't throw them away. They'd reuse them for things. So you set up a Roman column, just a column there, and you'd arc the prisoner over and you'd tie him down to the column. So his back is exposed. He's stripped naked. And then they would begin lashing him. But the cat of nine tails was different than the punishing lash. The punishing lash was just leather. The cat of nine tails was leather that was treated in such a way where it was stiffened. They would, I'm sorry, forgive my frankness here, but they would soak it, for instance, in cow or horse urine. And that would make it stiff. They would embed pieces of lead, glass, or other types of stones that were sharp along the length of all nine of these pieces of leather. And at the end, because they treated it in the animal stuff, they would be able to bend the ends of the leather like that, and then they would retain their shape. So you have hooks. That's a cat of nine tails. That's what they used on prisoners to extract from them a confession. It was brutal enough so that after you lash a prisoner 39 times, it tended to kill them, or it could even, and again, this is PG-13, that it could disembowel them. It was that brutal. It was that bad. Now, what did Pilate do to Jesus? Well, chapter 19. Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. And they came up to him saying, Hail, King of the Jews, and struck him with their hands. Now, the soldiers begin to mock Jesus. Who are these soldiers? They're in the palace. That means that they're praetorians. They work their way up the ranks. They're elite, but they are Roman soldiers. And they're only there with Pilate because they're really good at being Roman soldiers. Pilate is having Jesus flogged in his palace. Not in the nice rooms in the palace. Every palace has dungeons and places where they can do things like that because palaces were designed to be a seat of justice before a king. And here is a governor. And he's got his elite guard there. And he's got all the parts he needs to make this work. He says, I will punish him and I'll send him back to you. Like, that's going to be enough. When you see him, you'll let him go. I want Barabbas dead. So we'll just do this and I'll appease you guys. That's what he's thinking. And he sends Jesus to be flogged. And then, when they're done flogging him, yes, I'll get back to this, but when they're done flogging him, they fashion a crown of thorns and they put it on his head. Now it says he twisted a crown. Very likely, it's the same type of thorn that you may have in your own front yard, just a Middle Eastern version of it. It's called the pyracantha bush. Yeah, some of you are going, ugh. Those of you who know where I live, I have a big hedge around my house. When we bought it, it had this great big hedge. And I have to trim the hedges once in a while, and they'd kind of gotten like extremely out of control over the last several months. And so I went out there and I'm hacking away at the hedges. And I get to one part of the hedges and you're cutting them with that little hedge clipper, you know, the electric thing. And then, you know, since I'm cutting them flat on the top, well, the branches are just falling on the top. So I'm reaching up and I'm grabbing the branches and throwing them to the ground. Because the hedge is about maybe 5 feet tall. And I get to this one section and I hack these things down and I reach over and I grab the hedges and ow! There's a pyracantha bush growing up through the middle of my hedges. I hadn't encountered one of those in a long, long time. But the thorns can be short, too, maybe about an inch long, and they're sharp as a needle. And they itch. They sting. They really, really hurt. They have the same sort of bush in Israel. They also have forms of acacia over in Israel that have thorns that are like nails about that long. So it's the same sort of thing. So we're talking about 2 to 3 inches long for fully grown. These guys may have fashioned that. There is another possibility. Fashioning a crown, because they were able to hit him with their hands and not puncture their hands with the crown of thorns that they put on his head, there is another possibility for a crown. It's only a possibility. I won't say which I think one way or the other. But you know how you have palm fronds with all of those like little saw blade spikes? They might have taken one of those and soaked it and just fashioned it, tied it off, and stuck it on his head. It would have looked more like a crown. And it would have been just as painful because it would have entered into his brow and around his head. But it would have even been more clownish to see him like that. And they were really into making somebody look humiliated. So who knows? So they make this crown of thorns after flogging him. They press it down on his scalp. It penetrates down through his scalp into his into a skull where it comes to rest. And then they came up to him saying, Hail, King of the Jews! The Romans hated the Jews. Please remember that. They hated the Jews. There were only a few Romans, and you find them in the Bible, some of them, centurions especially, very friendly towards the Jews, very respectful towards the Jews. But these guys are praetorians who came from Rome, who are hanging out with Pilate, who is anti-Semitic. And we know that because Pilate's patron, as I told you, this fellow's name, his name was Lucius Sejanus. And Lucius Sejanus wanted the Jews exterminated. He just couldn't get the power to do it. And then he was killed because he tried to assassinate Tiberius, and it didn't work. And Tiberius was the emperor. And that put Pilate in a very precarious position because he was friends with an insurrectionist himself. And that was his patron. You didn't need to know all that, but I thought I'd tell you. So, see, Pilate said, went out and said to them, See, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know I find no guilt in him. This statement is why I am convinced personally that Jesus was not whipped with leather lashes, but scourged. Because Pilate brings him out saying, I find no what in him? That means it was an interrogation. And that means Jesus was scourged with a cat of nine tails. A cat of nine tails. When Pilate brought Jesus out, this picture is inaccurate. Nice clean back, but a crown of thorns. I will not leave this picture up there. I am not fond of this movie, but it's called The Passion of the Christ. There's a lot of doctrine in there that isn't true to the Bible and circumstances that don't match the biblical account. But that does. And after his scourging, Jesus probably looked something more like that when they brought him out. Because that's what a scourging would do to a person. Yes, on his chest, yes, on the front of his legs, these things wrap around. It was a horrible, horrible torture. And the reason they lashed him 39 times was because 39 was considered that, for them, the number of mercy. Because 40 was a number of judgment. Remember, how long did the flood endure? Yeah, and you've got 40 with judgments all through the Bible used in the symbolic sense, but it carried over into the behavior that they put towards the Jews. 40 was the number of judgment, 39 was the number of mercy, 40 less 1. Besides, if you happen to be lashing somebody and you got carried away because you hated them, you're simply the soldier lashing somebody. You're not like a policeman. You're not dispensing justice. You are merely carrying out the sentence. And if you lash that person 41 times, guess what? You get to take their place. Justice must be done justly. Even though the Romans were brutal, they believed in justice. And so they held to it. So Jesus was lashed with a cat of nine tails. It was an interrogation, according to John, because Pilate says, I find no guilt in him, which means I'm sending him back to try and extract something from him. Jesus was lashed, and when he didn't cry out. How is that possible? When there's nothing to confess, there's nothing to say. There's nothing to say. But also what that means is that he took the full brunt of the scourging. Because when you confess to anything, even the smallest of things, then they ease up. Jesus had nothing to confess to. Jesus is the truth. He not only tells the truth, he is the truth. He speaks the truth. He is the truth. There's nothing to confess to. So once the Romans got going on him with the cat of nine tails, they got going hard. So when Jesus was brought back out with Pilate, he was a horrendous, horrific mess with the crown of thorns on him. And of course, mercilessly, they put this robe on him, which if you're bloodied to the way he is down to the bone, that robe is going to stick. It was bad. I know you know this, but this was the extent of which he suffered before he even gets the cross, much less goes and gets nailed to it. A completely sinless, guiltless man, tortured to extract a confession by a governor who didn't care about a confession and really didn't even want one from Jesus. He just wanted to appease the mob so he could get Jesus set free. Here's this pathetic man. He's not going to be a problem to you ever again. Release him, not Barabbas. Besides, I'm sure in Pilate's mind, he probably wouldn't survive the scourging anyway. But here he comes. If Jesus didn't survive the scourging, then he could automatically take Barabbas out and crucify him. It wasn't a problem. Pilate wasn't being nice. Pilate wasn't being merciful. He didn't care about the Jews. He didn't care about Jesus. He's trying to save his own neck and get the problem of Barabbas off his back. He can't afford another riot. And things are so intense. There at the judgment seat with these guys shouting, crucify him! Crucify him! And if this gets out of hand, and Pilate is recalled to Rome, Tiberius will have his head, literally. So verse 5. Jesus came out, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. And Pilate said to them, behold the man. Ecce homo. Behold the man. Why did he say that? The answer is so obvious that when I ran across it, I went, duh! What was Jesus being accused of? Making himself a king. He was being accused also of blasphemy by the Jews, but blasphemy didn't ring well with Pilate. Pilate didn't care about blasphemy. That was a religious thing. But you make yourself a king, that means you're trying to supplant Caesar and Roman authority, and that'll get you killed. Pilate brings him out and says, "Behold the man, not your king." He will say that, but not here. He wants Jesus to be pathetic. "Behold the man." In other words, not the king. He's a man. Behold him. He's just a guy. Verse 6. When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." Those are the words of an exasperated man. They can't do that. Pilate knows it. He's just saying, go do it yourself. They turn on Pilate and they say, "The Jews answered, 'We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God.'" The law, in case you're wondering what it is over in Leviticus 24:16. "Whoever blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him, the sojourner as well as the native, when he blasphemes the name, he shall be put to death." Remember, Annas, Caiaphas, both heard Jesus in their ears, and actually Jesus affirmed it, declare himself the Son of God, which means he's equal with God. That's the blasphemy they were looking for. So in the eyes of the Jewish people, we can kill him and they will understand because he blasphemed. But in the eyes of Rome, they don't care because that's a Jewish matter. So we got to get him on other grounds. He's a king. But they said, "We have a law." So now it's back to the religious matter. We can't kill him. We're supposed to stone him. But we can't do that. You took the right of capital punishment away from us, so we can do nothing about it. So we have a law. According to the law, that he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God. Now that got Pilate's attention. Pilate, it says, when he heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered his headquarters. He takes Jesus with him. So he goes away from the bema, and he goes back into the palace. Jesus is dragged with him. And he said to Jesus, verse 9, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Pilate is now worried, very, very worried. In fact, I would say he's scared. But he's not so much scared of the crowd now. Now, who's Pilate? He's a Roman. He's a pagan. He's from Rome. He's not a Christian, and he does not believe in God, not the God that we believe in, who made the universe, the God of the Jews. He doesn't believe in that. But here's this man who has said extraordinary things. His wife comes to him and says, "Don't mess with him. I had a dream about him," which means that's from the gods. And then they say, "He made himself out to be the Son of God." And here's this bloody mess standing in front of Pilate, knowing Pilate's responsibility was putting those stripes on him. And he says, "Who are you? Where are you from?" Pilate is like any other pagan. He's superstitious. And to a pagan extent, he's religious. Now he's messing with the God of the Jews. That's all he thinks of God. He doesn't think of God as Lord God, King of the universe, creator of all that is. He doesn't think of God that way. He thinks of God as the God of the Jews. But that means that Pilate thinks God is a local God. He's not, but Pilate thinks he is. That's the way pagans thought. You know, when you changed regions, you changed gods. You know, you made sure you treated the gods of that region right, or they might treat you bad. Suddenly, he's the Son of God. Maybe. And I just did that to him. Where are you from? Pilate is scared. I might have just messed with divinity. Not that Jesus is God, King of the universe. He is. Pilate doesn't know that. He doesn't believe that. But to the Romans, even an angel could be divine. Caesar could be divine. But someone with spiritual power and authority, they could be divine. And if you do that to a divinity, what are the gods going to do to you? See what's happening? Pilate's scared. Where are you from? But Jesus gave him no answer. He said nothing. So Pilate said to him, "Will you not speak to me? Do you not know that I have the authority to release you and the authority to crucify you? I can let you go. I can crucify you." Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me." In other words, read, you have none at all. No authority over me at all, unless it had been given you from above. Pilate's worried that this man is from above. And Jesus just let him off the hook. "You would have no authority either to free me or to crucify me if it weren't given to you from heaven." Pilate doesn't understand where Jesus is coming from, but he gets the idea that Jesus just gave him permission to do whatever you want. And that must have staggered Pilate. That really, really knocked him for a loop, because this man, who is obviously a good man, and they couldn't get a confession out of him even with all that scourging, and now he's acting like someone from another world, and his wife warns him about it, and she's had this dream. Superstitious Pilate is now terribly worried, and Jesus says, "My Father has given you the authority. Do with me what you want." Remember what he prayed in the garden. "Let this cup pass from me, Father, but not my will, but yours be done." In the garden while he's being arrested, and Peter is attacking, trying to protect him, and Jesus said, "Should I not drink this cup, Peter? I have to drink it. That cup of God's wrath against sin. And this is part of drinking that cup. Part of the punishment for our sin." And Jesus said, "Do it." He put nothing in Pilate's way to stop him. He didn't plead for his life. And with that statement, he opened the door to crucifixion. Jesus did. "Pilate, my Father gave you the authority that he had." But then Jesus adds something. And this is fascinating. "Therefore," middle of the verse, "he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." Who delivered Jesus over to Pilate? Well, we can say God did, but yeah, the Jewish leadership. These are the guys running the temple, facilitating the sacrifices, making sure people worship God properly. And he says, those guys are completely outside their authority. Remember, Caiaphas and Annas had multiple high priesthoods even in a row. They weren't supposed to do that. They had violated God's law while telling people they were keeping it. And everybody knew it, but they went along with it because they must know something, because they're in charge. Don't ever do that with your leaders. Me too. You make sure you check all things with the Scripture. He says right there that a Roman pagan governor has more authority now than those guys over God's holy temple. They are the real sinners. Pilate was a rotten guy. And look at the mercy the Lord had on him. Verse 12. "From then on, Pilate sought to release him. But they cried out, 'If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar.'" Pilate is in a tight spot. He is Caesar's friend, but it's only a title. It's not a relationship, a friendship that he has. Remember, his patron, Lucius Sejanus, is trying to kill Tiberius and take over and be the next emperor. And maybe that had been found out by this time. Maybe Pilate knew that Sejanus was dead. If that's the case, he's vulnerable. One bad report to Tiberius, because he was associated with Sejanus, a Roman insurrectionist who wanted to kill the emperor. Pilate's dead. Take him back to Rome, cut off his head outside the walls. That's what they would do. If Sejanus was still alive, it didn't matter, because the fact of being a friend of Caesar, you had to make sure that you upheld his laws. If you didn't, bring him back. The very least that would have happened to Pilate under those circumstances, banishment. Well, he sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha, which of course was right there at that bema seat. This is where the judgment of execution goes down. Now, it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. There's a little controversy about this. Some people say the sixth hour was noon, but by the way this day has been measured so far, it's probably about 9 a.m. Okay? So we'll go with that. I'm not going to get into details about that, but it's probably about 9 a.m. It's quite early still. And he said to the Jews, "Behold," not the man, "behold your king." And they cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" And Pilate said to them, one more time, trying to get Barabbas on the cross, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." Talk about blasphemy. Every single one of those guys who said that could have been taken out and stoned during Moses' day. So he delivered him over to be crucified. I want to fill in one more blank. I want to read you a few scriptures, and then we're going to partake of communion. Great day to do it. Matthew 27, verse 24. Backing up just a little bit. So when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather a riot was beginning. So now you can see how agitated the crowd is getting. They're working them up, and this is putting pressure on Pilate. He took water and washed his hands. You know the famous scene. Before the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves." And all the people answered. A very strange irony. Once again, God teaches through ironies. All the people answered, and these are the Jews who opposed Jesus, the Jewish leadership, along with a crowd of people they probably paid to be there. They answered, "His blood be on us and our children." In other words, they were saying that we believe he's guilty. But we look at it, and John looked at it because the Lord had him write it down, that Jesus will even forgive them if they would only come. That the blood of Jesus Christ shed on the cross as the great altar of God to forgive mankind, every person who ever lived, is living now and ever will live, to forgive them of their sins. That their blood is even on them. His blood is even on them. Even though they won't receive it, they have rejected him. And that's horrifying. Then he released Barabbas. Having scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified. Verse 27, then the soldiers and the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole battalion before him. This is not a cohort, a Roman cohort of 6,000 men. Again, it's probably between 60 and 160 men. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him and twisted together the crown of thorns and so forth. And they put a reed in, and he held it like a scepter. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, "Hail, King of the Jews." And after they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe that had to hurt, and put his own clothes on him and led him away to crucify him. He's not even dead yet. This is part of the price of our sin. This is what our sin looks like to God. Please never justify your sin. Never think God winks at sin. This is what it looks like to Him. And this is just the beginning. Because next time, we go into the crucifixion and what happened there. And along the way, it'll take us a few weeks. Vic read something last week. I'd like to read it to you again without comment and a few other verses to follow. And then we'll have the ushers come up and we'll partake of communion. Isaiah 52, verse 13. Do you see Jesus? Do you see Him on the platform? Do you see Him going back and forth from a dungeon back up to the judgment seat? Do you see Him bleeding? Do you see Pilate not knowing what to do with Him? Do you see the people raging against Him, a riot nearly breaking out? This is what God has to say about it. All of that. Got it in your head? Behold, My servant shall act wisely. He shall be high and lifted up. He shall be exalted. As many were astonished at You, His appearance was so marred beyond human semblance and His form beyond that of the children of mankind, so shall He sprinkle many nations far beyond the borders of Israel. Kings shall shut their mouths because of Him. For that which has not been told them, they see. And that which they have not heard, they understand. Who has believed what He has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For He grew up before Him, a young plant, like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at Him, and no beauty that we should desire Him. He was despised and rejected by men. A man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces, He was despised. And we esteemed Him not. Surely He has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, and yet we esteemed Him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon Him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And by His wounds, we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on Him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed. He was afflicted, yet He opened not His mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, like a sheep before its shearers is silent, so He opened not His mouth. By oppression and judgment He was taken away. And as for His generation, who considered that He was cut off, cut out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of My people? And they made His grave with the wicked, with a rich man in death, although He had done no violence and there was no deceit in His mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush Him. He has put Him to grief. When His soul makes an offering for guilt, He shall see His offspring. He shall prolong His days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in His hand. Out of the anguish of His soul, He shall be satisfied. By His knowledge shall the righteous one, My servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and He shall bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will divide Him a portion with many, and He shall divide the spoil with the strong, because He poured out His soul to death He was numbered with the transgressors, and yet He bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. 1 Corinthians 1:18. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. How could this do any good? But to us who are being saved, what you just heard today, what you saw today from the Scriptures, for us who are being saved, it is the power of God. Galatians 2:20. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave Himself for me. Galatians 6:14. But far be it from me to boast except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. Hebrews 12:1-4. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider Him who endured from sinners such hostility against Himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted in your struggle against sin, as you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your own blood. Folks, Jesus suffered. We Americans, despite all that's gone on and the changes that have happened recently, live in Disneyland. To live for Christ is to follow Him. And Jesus said, and I'm going to leave you hanging here, but we finish with this and then communion. If any man come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Now, he said more after that, but that's another sermon. Are you a follower of Jesus Christ? Do we follow Him? Where's He going? Where did He say He was going? In what footsteps do we follow? They're bloody footsteps. Not because we have fought with swords and fists, but because, like Him, He laid down His life for others. And this, these trials, and this heinous thing done before Pilate is just the beginning. That's the deny yourself part, because there, while Jesus was on trial, He could have defended Himself. He could have called down 72,000 deadly angels to defend Him. But He didn't. He stayed silent. He spoke the truth. He opened the door for God's will to be done, no matter how painful it was. And then He stepped through it. You follow Him. Jay, where are you going with this? Wherever God is taking you. This is the path we walk. This is the good news we're talking about? Well, the story ain't over yet. Jesus beat the system, okay? But this is what we walk. Have you ever wondered why Paul said, as I mentioned at the beginning, I want to participate in the fellowship of His sufferings? To be able to walk in the world and stay pure. To keep my mouth shut when being provoked to wickedness, provoked to even defend myself when the defense should be self-evident. I follow Him. Follow Him. This is the deny yourself part. The next part, next time we talk, will be take up your cross. Father, thank You for showing us these things. Now, Lord, take us further on this journey in our minds and our hearts as You have filled us up with Your Scriptures and brought these things home to us. And yet, Lord, the journey isn't over as we continue to follow in Your Word. For now it goes to the cross. And yet, O Lord, You called us to follow in these footsteps. Lord, help us to throw off everything that entangles us. The fear of pain. The fear of accusation. The fear of shame. And like Jesus, walk this path where our flesh can finally die, where we could live life in the Spirit, uncompromised and unsullied by this world and all its temptations. We can't die for others like Jesus did. We know this, Father. And we thank You, Lord Jesus, for dying for us. But like You now, help us to live for others even if we bleed for it, that they might know You, that they might know Your forgiveness and Your loving kindness and Your goodness. Oh God, keep us filled with Your Holy Spirit and keep us in this place where You can use us to show the world the goodness, the greatness, the sacrifice, the life, and the power of Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name, and everyone said, Amen.